Well, welcome to the West Coast Project podcast for True Detective. This is the third episode in the first season. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Mike.
How's it going?
It's going good. How's it going with you?
It's funny. It's funny to stop the conversation and get into like the podcast mode.
Yeah, I know. But lots to talk about. Lots of things we didn't even finish before when I went back and looked at the notes, even though the time went so long. Things that I think are important to it, but
I'm having the hardest time getting my beer can soldiers to keep standing up.
Maybe it's a specific kind of beer. Maybe you have to be in Texas or have Texas beer.
I don't know. I'm ready to give up on them, though.
Oh, don't give up. I have faith in you.
This episode 3 is called The Locked Room, and our podcast is about our interpretations of The Locked Room. And we already have seen up through episode 7, so we're going to have all kinds of spoilers and guesses and stuff we actually really know. So if you don't like spoilers, don't listen anymore.
Turn it off.
So, you got anything to start off on?
Oh, geez. I actually did. We were talking about the last episode, episode 2, we were talking about the visions that Cole was being real forthcoming about with GMP when he's being interrogated, interviewed, however you want to put that. Do you think that he was telling them the visions? Because I think that's what we had talked about, is that he was telling them specifically about the visions. Is that right?
Uh-huh. I think he was being honest with them.
Well, I know he told them he had visions, but I didn't know if he was articulating the visions to them or not. The only reason I brought that up is because in a future episode, not this episode, but the next episode, when we find out what happens in this specific case with Ledoux, he doesn't go into, they keep their secret, but we see what goes on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think there's an implication there. Because like when he talks about the visions in episode 2, and then we see the vision, but we don't hear him say the words, like then the birds spiraled into a symbol similar to the victim. I don't think we have to hear that to understand that that's what he was telling them.
Okay. I was just, I couldn't put together in my mind, since in another case we know he's saying one thing and the actual facts of it are something else. And I couldn't get it into my mind if I wasn't convinced about if he was completely honest about all of his specific visions or not with them.
Yeah, because I think if they wanted you to think that, like, is he just telling them vaguely? I think we would have had to have heard from the two detectives, like, well, what did you see? Describe what.
Right.
But we saw it, so.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I guess since he wasn't telling something different than what it was showing us seeing, like it does in that other scene, then I guess we're to assume that he's actually describing the scene as he experienced it.
Did you ever think that Cole was under arrest and that he couldn't leave at any point?
Well, not after they bought him a six-pack and let him smoke cigarettes, which was pretty soon after it started. Maybe in the very first of the first episode, but it didn't take long. I don't know of anybody under arrest necessarily that they buy you cigarettes and or let you smoke cigarettes and buy you beer.
Yeah, and I guess he was describing his life and where he was outside of that office, what he was doing. But he was dressed in very, like, almost prison gray colored clothes.
Yeah, and he had that kind of, I don't know, demeanor. But at the same time, it's like you were talking about, it's almost like he was interrogating them as much as they were interrogating him. And I can't believe that we forgot one of the most profound sentences that he said, in my opinion. In episode 2, he goes on this whole thing about what he thinks of the hubris it must take to yank a soul out of non-existence into this meat, talking about the human body, I'm assuming, and to force a life into this thresher. And then he goes on to say, my daughter spared me the sin of being a father.
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty, think about that in relation to what we're talking about, all these young girls and everything that's going on with these young girls losing. And he does it again in this episode, so I'm probably getting ahead of myself, but.
Well, so we start out, they're back, they're still at that church, like, gathering evidence, and it looks like they've been there all night. It looks almost like the morning has come, you know, it's like morning scene of that church.
Right.
And there's a team of evidence people there. And then they try to track down, because that church is burned down, they try to track down where the congregation has gone.
Yeah, and we find out it had been burned about 4 months prior. But we also find out that about 2 months prior to it being burned is when the congregation had actually left, and it was burned without a congregation, so to speak.
Yeah, so they move pretty quickly from that burnt-out church scene to this revival being given at a tent by Reverend Joel Theriault. Or Theriault, and we meet this guy for the first time, and that's Shea Whigham. He's the brother of Nookie in Boardwalk Empire, and
yeah.
he gives a rockin' sermon.
Yeah, isn't it great? I mean, doesn't he? It is so realistic.
Right, and in the scene we kind of see his sermon kind of fades in and out, and then we hear Cole and Hart talking in and out. But there's a full version of that sermon on YouTube. You can watch. It's like 6 minutes straight of him just like really going at it. It's really good.
Yeah, maybe you can link to that too. You did a great job linking to all that stuff. So maybe we can get that stuff linked. I think it's so much easier when you can click on that stuff. Did you notice the Bible verse over his head as he was speaking? Because it really went along with what they were saying.
What did it say?
Well, it was Proverbs 3:5, and that Bible verse is, "Trust in the Lord with all thine heart and lean not into thine own understanding." And that's kind of what they were talking about, Cole and Hart back there. They were talking about it, how these people tend to follow this belief blindly, is, of course, Cole's take on it. And, of course, Marty has different ideas. But it was interesting that they even went to that much trouble to link that Bible verse, I thought, to specifically what the guys were talking about in the back of the revival.
Yeah, Cole's pretty much ripping any and all religions. He's like, just look around. What do you think the average IQ is in here? All I see is obesity, poverty, and people listening to fairy tales. And nobody's going to be splitting the atom in this crowd.
Yeah. And then Marty makes the comment that if people didn't believe, can you imagine what they'd get up to, you know, get into, do? And Cole says he doesn't see a difference. It's just that they'd do it out in the open. But Marty disagrees with that. He says he thinks there would be chaos or whatever if there wasn't a religion. And then Marty says that, and Cole says that that would make people really bad if that was what was keeping them from committing such acts. The real interesting dialogue they had back there.
Well, they say religion's the opiate of the masses. And they say that about a few things. Television's the opiate of the masses. But it's like something to keep you from viewing life for its cold, bare facts. Maybe it's kind of a deflection or, a nice way to view life without having to view it brutally honestly.
Well, Marty says when Cole says all that stuff and he keeps talking about the end of life, that he seems panicked by it. And I thought that was an interesting choice of words when he said he seemed panicked, because I would describe Cole in many ways, but I'm not sure I would describe him as panicked. What do you think?
Well, I thought it was interesting that Cole's like putting down the preacher and how he's like making fun of him, but Cole's giving a sermon of his own, and maybe just to Marty as his only congregation, but Cole's pontificating, you know, he's giving a sermon on what is wrong with religion, almost like it's his religion.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
We've all got a life trap. You know, we think we can move to another city to find happiness or fulfillment or closure. and fulfillment and closure are two jars that hold this fucking shitstorm together. You know, nothing's ever fulfilled. Closure, nothing is ever fulfilled, and there's no closure. Nothing is ever over. So that's a sermon to me.
Yeah, he says, nothing is closure until the very end. That's funny. I took down that same note.
So how did Reverend Terrio register on your guiltometer at the time of this episode?
Oh, I never thought he was guilty. I didn't know if it wasn't some part of the congregation, of course, or something like that. But I didn't think of him as guilt. Come on, it's Nucky's brother. He's a good guy.
Well, but he studied under Tuttle at one of Tuttle's academies.
Yeah, but how many other people did? I don't know. I didn't think necessarily anything about him specifically. I didn't even necessarily take that they thought it was about him. Did you?
I considered it for a minute. Like, why were they showing him? And, you know, what was the reason for this church? And, you know, it was a pathway for Dora Kelly Lang to go through. But why, you know, why did they spend so much time there? But we did find out that he learned his sermon preaching, whatever they call that, skills, speaking skills, leadership skills as a preacher under one of Tuttle's academies.
Yeah, Billy Lee Tuttle is what he says. He come up under Billy Lee Tuttle. I love the vocabulary that they use and how authentic, of course, it's going to be, but I love that. He come up under Billy Lee Tuttle. And they also ask him at this point about the mural on the walls in the church, and he says the children painted it, which was like one of those goosebump moments if you really took the time to pay attention to that one little sentence.
Right. So. It's a pretty weird picture for kids to paint, even taking away this ominous thing that we know that they're probably hearing about these, they're probably getting the idea from somewhere pretty bad. But just to paint like a naked woman on the side of a church wall?
It's not my idea of a perfect mural on a church wall, but... Okay.
So what about Bert the Mope? Did he ever register on your guiltometer? Bert, the goofy guy, chubby guy.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. I'll guiltily say yes, he did, but I kind of hate that he did because you feel bad for him. He's obviously a guy who isn't of the highest intelligence, and he has some issues. You can tell that he's not quite all there, and he's kind of pitiful, but yeah, that worried me a little bit when they started asking about him, and specifically when they said he had a conviction for indecent public exposure outside of children's school.
Yeah.
So, yeah, kind of.
Marty,
what about you?
Marty tries to convict him. But Cole writes it off right away. That was too simple, just too easy, you know, for him to be part of it.
Well,
did you think? I guess at the end of this, we kind of figure out a little bit more about Reggie Ledoux. But did you think that finding Reggie Ledoux would be the culmination of this anthology, like at the end of episode 8? Did you think Reggie Ledoux was like the linchpin in this whole thing?
I kind of did, didn't you?
Yeah, at this point, I think I did.
Because that's where all the fingers pointed to. And we're not really there yet quite in this episode, but it pointed harder and harder toward this guy. And then, you know, we kind of find out that wasn't the case.
Well, yeah, we think we're looking for this yellow king or king in yellow, and we're looking for kind of this mastermind, mysterious person that's hard to find, and he's kind of interlaced with all these people. He's been in a cell with Charlie Lang, and he's kind of hinted at as being this really important person. And even at the end,
and he was in a way.
Well, yeah, he's important to a certain degree, but he's not. I mean,
but he's not the guy.
Once we've reached, I forget what, four or five. Or six or seven, I guess, whatever number we find, he's not, I mean, I don't even think about him anymore.
No, I agree.
So, so Hart is trying to hammer poor old Bert, like, well, hey, we got him. He's, you know, he's been exposing himself, and but Cole just almost laughs it off. It's laughingly like a bad guess.
Yeah, well, Cole takes him. Cole is questioning, oh, how do you say his name? Nucky's brother.
Terrio? Joel Terrio?
Yeah, yes. He's questioning him about Bert, and Terrio asks him to take Bert into the RV trailer thing and talk to him specifically alone, and he'll get his answers that it's not him, remember? And then Cole goes into the RV alone with him, and he finds out that Bert had done a couple years for the indecent exposure outside of school, and evidently one of the gang members in prison was not fond of that, and so they essentially they neutered him, said they did a bad job of it. And Dora Lang was, well, I assume she was raped. I guess that's what they said. I know they said she had had sex, so not with this guy.
Yeah, that guy Bert was just a sad sack kind of guy. I mean, at least we think. Who knows? Who might pop up in season 8 and episode 8 is like a mastermind, but I doubt it.
I'm thinking no, but who knows?
So the back to G and P are interviewing Hart, and they ask if he thinks Cole was trying to push things the way that he wanted them to go. But Hart defends Cole after hearing that question.
Yeah, he does that repeatedly. They keep trying to sort of lead Hart in that way. They want Marty to say that Cole wanted this to happen a certain way. You can tell definitely at this point that they want him to say Cole wanted things to happen a certain way with this case. And that's another good thing about Marty. He's telling the truth. He
yeah.
could completely just bury Cole.
Well, he's vested, though. If Cole gets found out, he gets found out. So he's self-preservation. He's in that mode.
Right. Obviously over some stuff. But still, he could, I don't know, he could lean them towards stuff. I don't know. I appreciate his honesty with that.
So next we see Cole mows the lawn for Marty. And Marty doesn't like it.
No, he doesn't lie. And that was the last thing you said at the end of the number 2 podcast. Marty calls Cole obsessive, but Cole says Marty is obsessive too, but not about the job. And then Marty says that that's not him, that he can keep things separate. You know, he goes into that, how he keeps everything separate, which we talked a little bit about before. And Cole says people incapable of guilt are usually able to have a good time that way.
Right. Yeah, Marty's pretty much a dick. He says, like, I can just drink one beer and I'm fine with it. Like, he knows Cole's an alcoholic.
Well, and he also goes in to say, I try not to be too hard on myself. And Cole says, that's real big of you.
Yeah.
You know, so it's this great little banter. It's funny. It's a comedic banter that they have back and forth. But it's a little digging, too.
Yeah, it's always digging.
Between
so, Cole mows the lawn, and I got to admit, I'd be mad if somebody mowed my lawn, too. If Cole mowed the lawn and left, even, I'd be mad. I like to mow my own lawn.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Because if anybody wants to come over and do the dishes, any girl, anybody, or cook, please, you don't even have to ask. Just show up and do the dishes.
What if she came over to do the dishes in a sweaty, skimpy top while you weren't home but your husband was and she was sitting there talking to him?
Does she do a good job on the dishes? I don't know.
Well, I think Hart didn't like Cole being there with Maggie, but I also think he probably didn't like him mowing the lawn. It's a guy thing.
Is it really? Guys like to mow
so
their own lawn?
Hart and Maggie then talked to Audrey about the paintings or the drawings that she did in her notebook.
Right.
What did you think about that?
Well, they show it, and it's just these crudely drawn, sexually explicit pictures that this kid's drawn. And she gives a pretty good answer to it. But how would she know that kind of... I don't think they were very thorough with their examination of her, of where... They talk about it later between themselves, Marty and Maggie do, and they don't... They still have questions, and it's questions that they never ask her. Where would you have seen this to know to draw stuff like this? Because it is kind of explicit for a little girl.
Yeah. Yeah, they asked why she did it, but not how she found out.
Right. Wouldn't you ask a kid where they had seen that before in order to recreate it that way?
Maybe, but this scene told me a lot more about Hart than about either Maggie or Audrey. She's crying, and Hart looks over her to see the basketball play on TV.
Oh, I know.
That was weak.
Well, he didn't even want to turn the game off to start the conversation. Maggie had to prompt him to do that, and he's annoyed that he even has to turn off the ball.
Yeah, but that's bad enough. But it's even worse to, like, she's starting to cry, and she's, like, burying herself into his chest, and he's, like, looking over her to watch the play.
Well, I think we've seen a lot of that kind of stuff with him, and it's like if it doesn't affect him personally, then he doesn't really care a lot about it.
So Maggie tells Hart, or Maggie tells Marty, I should say, they're both Harts. Maggie tells Marty, girls always know before boys because they have to. What does she mean by that?
You know, I listened to that, and I think that could have been taken a couple of different ways. Did you have any specific thoughts on it as a guy before I tell you my girl thoughts on it?
Nope, I have zero thoughts.
Okay. For one thing, I think girls mature in that area before boys do. So girls have maybe the added pressures of knowing stuff while boys still think girls have cooties and stuff. But I think a lot of times, particularly in this instance, they're talking more about the things you have to watch out for with being touched inappropriately. I don't know that guys wouldn't need the same thing. I don't know. I didn't raise boys, but I kind of took it as her saying that you have to educate girls on sexual things maybe earlier than you would want to.
Well, one of your answers is perfectly plausible, but the other one is more ominous, and that's, I guess, what I'm trying to ask.
And that's
girls mature sexually before men or males do. Females mature first. But because they have to, kind of means, I think, that men or older people will take advantage of girls, and girls have to beware of that. That's what I took from it.
It felt ominous to me, the way she said it. That's definitely how I took it. The second way was more of a, we have to let girls know about being touched badly and that kind of stuff. That's not exactly what she said, but that's exactly what I heard.
I don't know. It was a creepy kind of ominous statement.
I thought it was too. And I think along the same lines, particularly in this religious community, girls are taught that they're the keepers of their body and how important that is. And I don't know that guys are taught that sternly at such a young age. I don't know, but I don't know that I felt like it was so much about little girl, little boy interaction. I felt like it was more, I don't know, it felt more about to keep yourself safe from unsafe activity. And I don't know why I felt like that, but I definitely got that from that interaction, and I didn't like that interaction at all. It was uncomfortable.
So Maggie warns Hart that she's close to ending it, and then she asks him about the space between them.
Yeah. And see, then he cares. Then he's not watching the ball game, because now something stands to be taken away from him.
So do you think he was sincere in that transaction? She says, you're smarter when I met you. You know, like, what do you think she meant by that?
I don't know. I remember her saying that. I took it more as just he's let it all go, his ability to hold his family together and stuff. But I don't know other than that. What did you think?
I don't think he's let it go. I think he's making a choice. He's aggressively seeking outside of the family activities. But I think he's turning on the fake charm here, you know, the pity party. Like, I'm approaching 40, and he knows that she's going to try to comfort him, because she does. She comes up, and she hates him almost, but she's, like, comforting him, because she's probably this really, really nice person. And even through all the shit that he puts her through, she still feels the need to, you know, help him, comfort him. And I think he was putting on a little bit of an act.
You think the crying and everything was an act?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Maybe. I kind of got the feeling that he means it. I think Marty means everything he says when he's with the court reporter girl. I think he means that. I think he means the interaction between them. And I think when he's at home with his wife, I think he means that. I really get the feeling that he's sincere in his emotions and in what he's saying in the moment, but he's given as much information to both these women as he can without getting himself completely, well, without them cutting, one of them cutting off from him.
Yeah, I think he's sneakier than that. When Maggie tried to start talking to him in this conversation, he like moved in on her and he was going to try to start kissing her.
Mm-hmm.
And she cut him off. She's like, no, you have to listen to me and listen to what I'm saying. He was trying to deflect it. He was trying to evade it.
Yeah, he didn't want to have that conversation.
But I also thought that this told us a lot about Maggie and her needs. Like, she needs connection desperately with this person or with a person. And she's married to this guy, and she probably has a really strong code of ethics. She's not going to go outside the marriage like Marty does. But so she needs this personal interaction, and even with Marty, who she's ready to end it with, you know, she's willing to take that.
I wonder, though, if she uses her daughter as an excuse in that. What do you think about that? Because she, when they go in the bedroom, this is presumably right after the conversation that they had with the daughter about the explicit thing she had drawn, and she said she's worried about her daughter because her daughter's always asking where dad is and when he's going to be around and what all's going on with this. And this is when he starts making the promises that the task force is about to get this case, and he, you know, blah blah blah, is about how he's going to spend more time with them and all this kind of stuff. I wonder if that's not an excuse on her part, because I do know that she's worried about her daughter. She makes that very clear. But I don't think she's happy. I don't think she's happy with Marty being there. And I don't think she's going to be happy if Marty spends more time there. I don't think their lack of time is really the issue. You see them in several different situations where they're sitting together and there's such a disconnect, they may as well not be.
Yeah, I believe I agree with you. I think she's being a little manipulative. Like, the girls are always asking when you're going to be home, when she, in fact, really wants to know when he's going to be home.
Right. That's what I was getting at. Not that I blame her necessarily, but I just kind of got that impression from her that she also has this. It's just the way they've learned to communicate, or the way they've allowed themselves to communicate with one another, which is so. They're just lost with one another.
So the scene cuts back to G&P with Marty, and then Marty wistfully, like, kind of looks up and off to the side, and you can tell he's remembering this with real sadness. Like, there's no faking here. He's like, wow, man, I really had something that I should have taken better care of. And he just looks really, really sad when he thinks back on this conversation that he's relating to G&P.
And do you notice what he does then? He looks down to his missing wedding ring. That was the first time I noticed that he's not married in the future. I didn't notice it before then.
Yeah, so we move up to Cole again, and Cole starts to show his boxman technique. And did you notice that... I didn't notice this the first time. I noticed on the rewatch, a big element in Cole's boxman technique, which is interrogating a prisoner and getting the truth, is that he touches people. he touches this guy, this poor sniveling guy. I forgot what he even did, but this guy's just begging to confess. And Cole's got his hands like almost on his back, like massaging his back, like making physical contact with him.
Yeah, I didn't notice that though, but you're right, thinking back on it. Yeah, he does.
We see another episode in the future where he sees this really pitiful woman that he's interviewing, and he holds her hand. He reaches out his hand, and she takes his hand.
What do you think about his techniques? They're effective, certainly.
Yeah, what else do you need to know? They're really effective.
They're effective, but it feels so dishonest and so manipulative. He doesn't mean a word he's saying. The comfort he's offering these people is, it's words is all it is. But he does say something there that I think is pretty important. He says that he's never been in a room with anybody for more than 10 minutes, that he didn't know if they were guilty or not.
Yeah, then he says, how long does it take you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And he's kind of comparing, I think at that point, himself sitting in there with these guys who he's been in there, well, 3 episodes now, so a long, long time, and they don't know, evidently.
Yeah, he says that people wear their hunger and their haunt in their eyes, and their eyes are in the front of the locked room, and he's implying that the mind is the locked room. And then the G&P kind of look at each other like, this guy's whacked. But of course, he's genius. You know, he's not whacked. He's genius. And then while he does that for a while, then he goes on this date that Maggie has set up for him.
Yeah, with the girl Jennifer. That was interesting on a number of levels, I thought. What'd you think about it?
Have you ever hosted a blind date that you set up for someone?
Well, yeah, years ago. Yeah, I have. It hadn't even been that long. Yes, I have. You feel kind of responsible for the interaction and the way people talk. But now they warned her. They warned her. They were talking to her. And by they, I mean Marty and Maggie warned Jennifer before Cole got there that he was sort of a bird of a different feather. But
introverted. Why do you think they made Jennifer look just like Maggie?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't notice that, but you're right. She did, didn't she?
It was hard to even tell them apart.
Well, I think that Cole has something for Maggie. I don't think it's necessarily for Maggie, but it's for, like we talked about before, the healing that he's gotten from Maggie.
So this girl, Jennifer, all she wants is a man who's not an alcoholic. And the first thing Hart does is pour him a big glass of beer when he sits down. And he's like, no, I don't want it. And so Hart pours the beer back into the pitcher. That was kind of weird. That was like Hart almost anticipating, like, oh, you're going to ruin another nice little conversation setting we have here by being yourself, aren't you, Cole?
Yeah, it's like a setup. It's like he's setting him up, I felt like.
But Cole's like the most interesting person in that room out of those 100 people at that bar. He's probably the most interesting person in the room.
Well, to me, I would agree. He's definitely different, and different's interesting.
So Marty spies his little girly goo across the room, and he goes to the bar to get away from Maggie and the rest of them, and she comes up and gets her beer refilled, and they kind of have a little interaction at the bar.
Yeah, and she kind of tells him that she's done, that they're done. But while he's spying the girl, and he's sitting there, and there's a conversation going on, the whole time Marty is looking at his court reporter girlfriend out on the dance floor, out on the floor talking to another guy, there's a conversation going on, and Cole is talking about tasting color. Did you pay attention to that conversation?
Yeah, he's talking about cross senses, how you can taste a color.
Right, and it's called synesthesia. And Maggie brings up that it can be a side effect of a statin medication, which is a cholesterol-lowering medication, and Cole says it's not a side effect. And a real interesting side note, I thought, to me, because I love that kind of stuff, is Nick
Pizzolatto, yeah.
Okay, yeah. He, the writer and creator of this show, has or said he had synesthesia.
Huh.
And that's, they kind of worked that in there. So I thought that was pretty interesting. It's where evidently you have synapses in your brain that grow together in a weird way. And so you associate colors and tastes and all this kind of stuff together. And it was kind of pointed out before in season one, because Cole had made a comment that he tasted, that this place put a bad taste in his mouth, but he said it differently. He worded it differently. Like he could taste the place. I thought he was talking about the toxins in the air or something like that, but it turns out that they were referencing back to this. So
yeah, at that point, he had said something like, it tastes like smoke and aluminum, and it was interesting that he was drinking aluminum cans of beer and smoking in the...
Well, right. But anyway, I just thought that was a really neat little thing that they threw in there, which was kind of a nod to the creator.
So help me out with the timeline. When the court reporter girl tells Marty that it's run its course and I never wanted to be married to you, is this before or after he disses her in the elevator at the courthouse? Has he done that yet? I don't think he has.
He has not. No, he has not. That wasn't even in this whole episode.
So that's very telling about her, because she tells him it's run its course and she's dating a guy, but later on when he tells her it's run its course, she gets all mad and flips out and goes wild on him.
She has feelings for Marty, whether or not she's able to act on those feelings or not. But here she's in the bar scene, I think she's digging at Marty. She says it's none of his business. She is not going to sit in this bar and watch him over there with his wife, out on a date with his wife, and watch them hang out. And then,
right, you're fucking your wife, right? And he gets all mad at that. Like she's doing exactly what he's doing, and no, there's no difference.
And Maggie even calls him on looking at her. Do you remember that? She asks why he's not paying attention or something, and he says he thought he saw somebody that was, I don't remember what he said, but it was not, and he keeps looking at her.
Yeah, I don't think Maggie catches him looking at her. She just catches him not being attentive to their table, and he says something like, oh, I thought I saw a guy that should have been at the parish, like he should have been in some other place and not in the bar. Yeah, I guess I had one last thought about the the woman. What's her name, the court reporter? Do you remember?
No.
Lisa?
No, I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember. But I thought it was interesting in the way that the writer put the story together and the dialogue together, that it's not just Marty being a poor husband and needing things. Maggie needs things too. You know, and it's not just Marty with his mistress needing her to be a certain way in an unhealthy way. She needs him too in an unhealthy way. There are these nuances that you can't just separate them, like one of them is right and one of them is wrong. The court reporter girl later on in the series is just as mad at Marty as Marty is at her in this bar scene. In fact, she does something really drastic based on the knowledge that she finds out. But she had already told him that it's run its course, but it hasn't run its course. She still has really strong feelings about it. Or she has really strong feelings about being dissed by Marty.
Is that what it is, or is she just still so angry at him? I can't decide.
I think it's all in the same, it's in the same vein as like when Audrey, Marty's daughter, tells him, you can't tell me how I should be and how I should dress and who I should connect to. And Marty dismisses the court reporter girl in the elevator, and she says, you can't do this. You can't be like this. You can't just dismiss people like this. So I think it was an interesting nuance that you don't just see Marty's the bad guy and Marty's the one with all the needs and stuff. Other people around him have these similar, if not as drastic, needs and faults.
I agree with that.
But yeah, so Marty, you were talking about Marty visiting the court reporter girl and her date, and he runs over the bike and goes up there, and all he wants to find out is if she had oral sex with the guy. And the poor guy is just like out on a date with this girl. And did you notice, was he holding up his cowboy belt buckle, or was that his badge, his detective's badge?
I thought he held up his detective badge, but I might need to go back and re-look because I'm not sure.
Yeah, I thought it was the detective badge at first, but watching it again, it looked kind of like that L-shaped State of Louisiana belt buckle he had.
Like, well, that would be funny.
But I guess holding the badge makes more sense. Like, you got to tell me because I'm a lawman.
And how guilty she must feel trying to pull this guy, this boyfriend, this married boyfriend off of this guy that she's allowed to bring her home.
Yeah, so Marty says, kind of laughs it off. He's like, okay, don't worry. I just don't want you to think I'm a psycho.
Mm-hmm. That's what he says.
That was crazy.
Yeah, that was crazy. And then we find out just right past that. Right after that, they skip to the present where he's talking to GMP and he says, you know, Rust always needed a family. A person needs a family for the boundaries. And I thought that was just so funny. So you got to put that right in the middle of this scene where he's just done this. And then it goes into where Cole's phone's ringing and it's Maggie. And she's asking him if Marty got a call to go out. She says, I hate to put you on the spot, but he told me he had to leave.
Right. That's more of that nuance, too, because Maggie, like, how does Maggie have such quick access to Cole's phone number? And she quickly turns the call from, like, hey, I'm worried about Marty. I think he might be screwing around on me, to, like, how are you? And how did the date go? And she turns it into, like, a social thing more than just a fact-finding call.
Well, even more than just social, she asked him if he went inside with Jennifer, with her girlfriend.
Right.
When he dropped her off. I mean, she gets kind of personal about it.
Do you think that was friendly curiosity or you think that was jealousy?
I think if a girl wants to know if a guy came inside with her girlfriend, she's going to ask her girlfriend, not ask the guy.
So what do you think? What do you think Maggie had in her mind when she asked Cole?
Truly, you might have to edit it out if you don't like what I said. I think she was jealous.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too.
Okay, good. Yeah, it was like this feeling of jealousy she had, because I don't know that she is sexually attracted to Cole and wants that kind of relationship with him, but I think she...
You don't know that?
No.
You don't know that? You're kidding me.
No.
She's obviously attracted to him.
Okay, but there's a different kind of attracted, you know? I think... With me, there's a different kind of attracted. I don't know if she's attracted to him because he's fulfilling that let me in, let me get close to you need that we all have. Or if, you know, and then there's a sexual attraction thing. And she hasn't really shown, she hasn't really acted sexually attracted to him. Maybe, but...
I think it's all on the same, it's just different points on the same scale.
No, that's what all guys think. That's what all guys
You don't
think
that the first thing towards sexual attraction is the fondness and the feeling of communication and comfort? And that's what Cole's provided to her that she's like hungry for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I do think that that can be. I don't think it necessarily has to be on the first step to being sexually attracted to somebody, but it certainly can be, particularly if it's any kind of a lasting relationship kind of thing. But I just feel like at this point, she just craves that openness with somebody. They've shown that she doesn't have it with her mother. We don't really know about her father, but you didn't really get that from that interaction. She certainly doesn't have it from her husband, but she does have it with him. And so she feels jealous.
Yeah, she's definitely clearly building an affection for him. You can see it in her face when Cole just cuts the call short.
Yeah.
He just hangs up the phone without saying goodbye, and she's like, wow. You can see her face just drop. So an interesting thing about that call is that Maggie says that or Cole says that Steve Garashi was the guy that, you know, or I guess Maggie said Hart said that. That was the excuse. He needed to go back out to the station. Is Steve Garashi or Garasi called him in? And Steve Garashi is the guy we find on the boat later on. He's the guy that Cole slapped in the office in the first or second episode. And then, as we found in episode 7, he's the guy that seems to have some pretty important information that they're about to go to any means to get.
So, what do you think about Cole not telling her? He knew. He said he didn't know, but he knew.
I think Cole was honest there. He didn't hear. He said, I didn't hear anything. And he said, Garazzi wouldn't tell me anything anyway because he hates me.
Yeah, and I believe all that, but you know he knows.
I don't think he knows.
Okay.
Why would I know that he knows? Why do you know?
Because he knows what he's done before. He knows how he is. He knows. I think he knows. I think he may not know, but he certainly would suspect. They're not going to just call him out, and if they do, he's probably going to call Cole, at least let him know.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I think he was covering for him there.
No, what? No, he didn't. He said I didn't hear anything, and the guy hates me, so he wouldn't have told me anyway. So he didn't really go. He didn't say either way.
But he could have called him. He could have done something. I don't know. And he shouldn't. I mean, I'm not saying he shouldn't have, but he didn't.
So Maggie says another interesting thing, or she has an interesting question, and she asks him kind of like why Hart is the way he is, and Cole says, guys know what we want, and we don't mind being alone. And I can relate to that. I think that's really kind of true of me anyway as a guy, that it's kind of weird being alone, but you can not mind being alone. It can be okay.
Now, when did she say that?
During that call.
Okay. I don't remember that part of it.
Like, why is he this way, or why are you guys this way? Maybe it was on the end of the conversation with, like, she could be good for you, you know, this Jennifer could be good for you. You know, why are you guys so indifferent to that? And Cole says, guys know what we want, and we don't mind being alone.
Yeah, but then she tells him, or maybe she tells him before that, but that there's comfort there. She said there's comfort there.
Yeah, he says that after he hears all that.
Okay.
So Cole's digging away. He's working. He's working and working it in his room there, in his nice lawn chair room. And he finds out by some of the files he digs up at the police station. But he finds out there's another victim prior to Dora. And that's
right.
That's the girl that drowned. But he finds out she had LSD and meth in her system, too.
And she also had that same spiral insignia on her back.
And it turns out she had some stab marks in her abdomen as well.
Right, that they had attributed to just being in the... They had attributed an accidental death in the flood from Andrew, right?
Yeah, because it was a couple of years before, and like you found out, it was 1992.
Right.
So they dig up... Although they said it was a flood in Abbeville...
Yeah, so I think that was after that. I think it was after that, maybe.
Well, in 1992, a flood in Abbeville. So maybe it was part of Andrew that hit Abbeville. Anyway, they find out she has a grandfather, and they go dig him up, and find him. He's still alive. But he comes pulling up in his little boat with yellow traps in it. Did you notice that at the time?
I noticed that he was a fisherman. I don't know that I noticed the yellow traps.
Yeah, that kind of made me perk up a little bit at a time with this all King and Yellow stuff. But I was hypersensitive to all clues. But they don't seem to have much to do with anything. But he tells them a little bit about Rianne and Reggie. And he doesn't like Reggie or his family. Reggie's father was an alcoholic and calls him coming from some low class, those low class Ledoux. And he gives Cole and Hart a box of Rianne's belongings.
Right.
And one other thing, I think that they figure out that the institute that Rianne went to was another one that was a Tuttle related place.
Yeah, it was one of the schools that was set up, is what they said, and that had closed down during Andrew in 92. He said that the grandfather said she had quit school in the 10th grade, and I think that's what he said, and he had a little box of her stuff left over. And he also said that he could tell by the way they were questioning him that there was more to this. He said, did she not die in a flood?
Right.
And, you know, he was telling them, I'm not stupid. And that was interesting to me because they really got the accent, really what we picture a stereotypical Louisiana Bayou accent with him. And so when he was saying, you know, I'm just a fisherman or whatever, but I'm not stupid. I know y'all are getting to something else. And that's when they said that there was another, well, that they were looking for somebody.
What were you going to say? Just say it.
Well, no, I was just going to say another murder, and they were looking for somebody in connection to it. So that's all. Wow. Yeah. What did you think I was going to say?
Well, I thought you were just kind of holding back.
No.
So one of the interesting things about in that box, one of the things they had was a yearbook. And I guess back at the time, either Darkness Becomes You or the HBO website or one of the Facebook pages or something for True Detective had posted a picture in the yearbook. And then they changed the picture.
Oh, really?
They changed a couple people in the picture and a couple of the clothes articles of clothing those people in the picture had. This was like the same picture in the yearbook that we looked at in the episode here, but it had a couple changes. So there's all this speculation on Reddit, like why did that person change? Like they changed one of the girls. They changed some of the shirts the guys were wearing in the picture. They just changed some weird stuff. Like it was really mysterious as to why they would have made those changes.
And they changed it after it had aired with the other stuff?
No, they changed the picture in the episode that shows the class in the picture. They changed the picture on the Facebook page was a different picture than the one in the episode.
Wow. Wonder why.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to it. I just know that they changed it.
It makes you wonder. I mean, could it have been a true yearbook picture that maybe they didn't have the rights to put up or something?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe somebody's likeness was in there.
That's interesting.
So they go to the institute that I guess that Rianne went to, and they find out it's shut down, but there's a guy cutting the lawn.
Right.
More lawn mowing going on.
Mm-hmm.
But Hart and Cole, or I guess Cole talks to the guy. Hart stays in the car. And Cole finds out a little bit more, but not too much. Not too much that helps us learn more about the story, really. What did you think about that conversation?
The conversation with the lawnmower
guy? Did you give that guy any consideration, the lawnmower guy?
Well, he just was talking about that the school had shut down after Andrew came through, and there was a sign up out front saying it had shut down. And no, I didn't really think anything about it. He said the parish had just put him on this detail a couple of months back, and it was a new thing. What did you think?
Yeah, he was at the time. He was very plausible. He was very believable, and his story all made sense.
Right.
I'm just told to cut the lawn, and we got this new contract to cut this lawn here. So here I am cutting the lawn. That's all you really knew. So while Cole's talking to this guy, Hart gets more info on Reggie on the radio in the car and honks the horn for Cole to come back over. And then they start driving like Walt on his way to Tahajali towards this They are driving like crazy.
Yeah, they put out an APB on Reginald Ledoux. They were excited. This was like they thought, you know, we were talking about how we thought this was the case buster. I think they did too.
Right. So we get a brief preview of that compound. And at the time, we didn't really know what we were looking at. And Cole's talking to the two detectives, and he says something about Vietnam and, you know, this compound out in the middle of nowhere just looked like a shack in the middle of the bayou.
And he also goes on to say a lot of other things. He talks about spending, it's stuff like that that makes the 14 hours of staring at the dead bodies worth it. He talks about looking into their eyes, and you can see all the love and the hate, and the memory was nothing but a dream. He starts saying all that kind of weird psychology kind of stuff that he says, and it was really creepy. He went on this little spiel for maybe a minute of just going on about stuff like that.
Yeah, G&P, Gilbo and Papania, had put a folder on the table in front of Cole, and then they left the room almost like tempting him to look in the folder. And why do you think they did that? This was earlier in the episode, that when they took a little break and they went out of the room, they had slid this manila folder kind of in between them and Cole.
Oh, I thought they were aggravated at him for his nasty sayings on religion.
You don't think they were daring him to peek in the folder?
Oh, probably, yeah, but I didn't think about that. That was when he was going on the religious rant against the revival scene, and one of the guys, the G guy, he was like, I got to get out of here from, or something, and he got up and walked out, and the other guy followed him. So that's how I took it, that they didn't like some of the stuff he was saying about that, but it probably was more about the folder, because I couldn't really understand. They've surely heard more offensive things than that.
Yeah, that seemed to me like some kind of a setup. We're so flustered. We both need to leave the room at the same time. And
right.
Meanwhile, here's this folder. But when you were describing Cole talking about how people can just die and let go and it's a feeling of relief, he starts talking about that as he opens the folder and looks at whatever's inside the folder.
And it's just picture after picture after picture.
Well, we don't know that.
Not at that point, right.
We don't know that, because what they show, the picture after picture after picture, those are pictures coming off like a teletype or a fax machine in another setting. It's not the folder. There may be pictures of dead people in the folder, but those were from a different room, like a different place in time.
Okay, so that wasn't the folder then of the new 2012.
It may be. I don't think we know exactly what's in the folder, but it's probably pictures because of what he's talking about.
Okay.
But they do show like a fax machine or a copy machine pumping out picture after picture. That's not the folder. It's really kind of, it's nuanced. It's not very clear because they switch to that scene.
But all that stuff he was saying was creepy. He's talking about how it's all like a dream. And then he says, and like a lot of dreams, there's a monster at the end.
Yeah.
And then that's when they go into, you assume that it's, and it is, Marty and Cole kind of stalking out the Ledoux compound place. And you see him walking. And that's creepier every time I see it.
Yeah, what do you think he was doing?
Well, I think he disposing of a body because he's got a hatchet. I mean, it shows him, I don't know, he's walking through a field in tighty-whities and nothing else with a big, huge machete in his hand and a gas mask on, with the hose hanging off of it, kind of swinging like an elephant trunk. And he just looks, it's the stuff of nightmares, I'm telling you.
Well, that's the meth. He's cooking meth, so that's why he's wearing the mask. I don't know
about the machete. Yeah, but he's outside, though. And he's got the machete in his hand. I mean, what's he doing out there, and why is he naked?
Well, he's probably walking. Well, Walt was naked when he was cooking meth in his underwear.
But he wasn't outside, was he?
Yeah. Well, he was walking away from where he wasn't. cooking meth outside. He was, I don't know, that's what I thought. He was leaving someplace where he was just cooking meth and either killing someone or doing something with the machete. But he didn't look like he was up to any good.
No, I can't imagine he was planting daisies or anything like that in that getup.
And then that's how the show ends. The episode ends when we just kind of wonder, like, did we find, is the mystery solved? We found the Yellow King and the Reggie Ledoux. Is that Reggie Ledoux or is that a new monster?
We're so gullible. In episode 3, we think we've got it all.
I don't think we knew that was Reggie Ledoux either, did we?
I don't know that we knew, but we knew they were headed toward him, and we knew that they said they were going to find him, and they seemed very confident in the fact that they could find him, and then it showed that. So yeah. I assumed that it was him, or at least, you know, his compound at that point, or whatever.
Yeah, I guess. But they did kind of say, like you mentioned, Cole said there's a monster at the end of every story, and then they showed this guy, like he's the monster.
That's creepy. That's the kind of thing, I don't know how guys feel about that kind of thing, but that mask and the naked, that's creepy stuff.
Yeah, that was quite a cliffhanger, because that was the week before the Super Bowl, and there wasn't a True Detective episode the next week. The only crime we saw the next week was, I guess, Peyton Manning getting murdered by a flock of Seahawks.
Oh, painful. You're stabbing me somewhere. Where am I?
But that was the break, and that was a long 2-week break, because we wondered, like, what the heck?
Yeah, and what's going to go on, and what are they going to find there? And then, of course, we find out later that everything they find is that and worse in a different way. We did skip a scene, though. There was a scene in between where they were talking about where they had found that there was another murder victim, and before they got to the grandfather's place, this little place with a population of 300, they're driving there, and Marty asks Cole if he thinks a man can love two women at the same time, and then he clarifies with be in love with them. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah.
And Cole says, I don't think man can love. I thought that was, it was an interesting take. And then he goes, at least not the way he means. Inadequacies always filter in. And then he starts talking about the pipeline covering the place, which kind of went into what you were saying about the industrialization of it and all that, and how it's all going to be underwater in 30 years and all this. And the whole time Marty's sitting over there, and he's got this kind of shattered look on his face. He's really troubled, and he's stuttering and everything. And he asks Cole ever wonders if he's a bad man. He's, you know, Marty says, do you ever wonder if you're a bad man? Do you remember that?
Yep.
And Cole says, no, I don't wonder, Marty. The world needs a bad man. We keep the other bad men from the door.
Yeah.
I thought that was a pretty good one, too.
That Cole, he's got an answer for everything.
He does. You can't help but like Cole.
The Broncos could have used him for some of the answers on the Seahawks. This is the episode, I think, where I started to really like the show. Like, I was kind of watching in and out. I don't think I had watched a whole episode up until this, back then. And I saw this kind of ending of episode 3, and I'm like, you know, this is probably worth checking into more thoroughly. And I went and I rewatched, like, the whole episodes of 1, 2, and 3. Because I think I had just watched parts of them at this point, back when they first started.
So what do you think overall?
I think it's good. I think back then I was looking at the way to figure out the crime, and I think now it's like the crime doesn't mean anything. It's like the people. Like, how are Hart and Cole going to conclude their lives? You know, how are they going to complete the mission that they have on Earth?
Well, even more importantly, how are they going to include us in it? On a very selfish level, because you may know this. I don't know. I'm assuming this isn't just a mini series of 8 episodes. So what's next?
It is over after 8 episodes.
It's over? There's not going to be another True Detective?
It'll be a different, whole different story, different characters. It's an anthology. It's 8 episodes. And that's it.
You just broke my heart just a little bit.
That's okay. What makes it beautiful, though. That's why there are a lot of people on Reddit and on other podcasts, they talk about like how Lost could have been a really good show if they had, you know, was originally planned for three seasons. Mm-hmm. And then it just became such a monster hit that they said, okay, four seasons. And then ABC said, no way, man, this is too much of a money machine. Keep it going. And what did it go to, like 7 seasons or 8 seasons? They stretched it way out. So they milked it dry, but this is it for True Detective season 1. You know, that's all for Woody and Matthew. That's probably why they signed on to it, because they knew they wouldn't be committed to, you know, multiple years of doing this show.
That breaks my heart. I did not know that, but because I really love these characters, and we've got another hour with them and then we're done.
Yep.
I keep investing myself in these men, you know, McConaughey and Harrelson, and like I did in Cranston, and I don't know.
Well, sorry.
That wasn't very sincere.
Yeah, I don't think it's very important to have your heart broken by a TV show. So I'd be more sincere if it was real, like I had to tell you something really serious.
You don't still miss Breaking Bad?
No, I appreciate it for what it was.
I actually do, too. I think it was great, and I think it ended perfectly. But I still pine for it a little. Just a little.
You got to move on, Michelle.
Okay.
Jeez. Look, you got this great show. There's going to be a show on Fargo. There's some pretty cool shows coming up.
What do you mean, a show on Fargo?
We're making a TV series about Fargo, the movie.
Really?
Yeah.
That was a great movie. That was one of the better black comedies, I thought, ever.
You got to read Variety. Get a subscription to more Hollywood gossip and catch yourself up.
Well,
about these shows.
Okay, maybe you'll link me to them, because I don't know. Maybe you'll let me into your Reddit underworld or something.
Yeah, it's pretty secret. You got to have all the passwords to get into Reddit.
Well, that's bad.
Reddit's, I mean, the front page of the internet, Michelle.
But I can't find what I'm looking. Okay, I'm not going to embarrass myself any more than I have, but I haven't been able to find what I'm looking for. My daughter does it all the time. I'll steal her stuff.
There's a little box at the top that says search, and you can look up stuff.
Okay.
All right. So any last thoughts on season 1, episode 3 of True Detective?
Just the cliffhanger is a great cliffhanger. It's making me really excited even to review number 4 so we can talk about it.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you then.
Okay, Mike.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.